Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ed Marcel. I'm one of the pastors at Terra Nova and serve X29 here in the Northeast. And I want to welcome you. Many are old friends and have been here multiple times, so welcome back. Some are new, so welcome. I view this as sort of a very unique and special church. If the ecclesia, the church, is the gathering of God's people, this is a gathering that meets not every Sunday, but now once a year, but has a particular potential that other churches don't always have. This is such an influential body, and I appreciate what you men and women do and live throughout the weeks in the churches throughout the Northeast. Many of us have had the same conversations at different times and different places, and the conversations went something like this: something is wrong with the status quo. I can't figure out how I can get the people of the tribe I'm from or friends of mine to communicate with the church. There seems to be such a sizable gap, it feels like we can never really close that. I've heard that conversation had throughout, you know, church planning conversations, denominational boards, at conferences, and many times we looked in different places. Hopefully we all looked back to the scriptures and were able to find something deep, profound, and biblical. And every now and again, we found the gift of mentors and guides on this journey. And it wasn't just the collective discussion of people who were Generation X or younger. It came from some wiser, more experienced mentors. And I can remember reading George Hunter's The Celtic Way of Evangelism and thinking, here's a man who is biblical, profound, historically informed, and speaking directly to today from all those sources. How many people here have read The Celtic Way of Evangelism before? I just want to give George an understanding of how many people, how many churches have been influenced by this work. So it's a great opportunity for us to hear him. And as we gathered for our first yearly gathering, I really wanted it to be somebody who would be able to give us that gift. George Hunter is a professor at Asbury Seminary. He served as dean there for 18 years. He told me he gave up administration for Lent, though, one year, never went back to it. He has a PhD from Northwestern, is the author of multiple books, including Church for the Unchurched and How to Reach Secular People. His latest book, The Apostolic Congregation, is available outside in the lobby. And there's a sign-up sheet for the 10th anniversary of the Celtic Way of Evangelism, and that will have a new section on the Celtic Way of Formation. And signing up for that today, the publishers have been very generous to give us like a 40%, I think that's right. If not, tell them I said it was. And a 40% discount on the cost of that book. We were blessed to have him speak here yesterday. He is the husband of one wife, the father of three children, the grandfather too, and a spiritual father to many sons in the church, Dr. George Hunter.
Well, my goodness, it's wonderful to see all of you this afternoon. Some rumors have been circulating. And one rumor has it that we have some Baptists in our midst. All of you who are Baptists, raise your hands. All right. I probably should go on record as saying that even though I'm not a Baptist, I love the Baptist Church, I admire the Baptist Church. Some of the greatest churches are Baptist churches. Some of the greatest preachers are Baptist preachers. Some of the greatest church leaders are Baptist church leaders. Some of my heroes are Baptists. Some of my best friends are Baptists. But I wouldn't want my daughter to marry one. I have been looking forward to spending this day with you, a day that we will never have again. May we be good stewards of this time together. One of our major struggles in Christianity in the West today is to rediscover apostolic Christianity. It's part of the ancient and future quest. Many church leaders now know deep in their hearts that there's something about the ancient primitive church that we need to recover. There's been no shortage of attempts to do that. At least some branches of the church, born in the Catholic tradition, believe that there is a sacramental connection through ordination that goes all the way back to Simon Peter, thus assuring apostolic continuity. The Eastern churches, however, believe that to connect with ancient Christianity is not so much sacramental as it is liturgical. If we just worship like we believe they worshiped, and if we can preserve and perpetuate those early to mid second century liturgies and import them intact without serious loss or distortion into every community, in every generation, we are apostolic. The reformers, like Luther and Calvin, took a different approach. They said it's not so much sacramental continuity or liturgical orthodoxy. It's beliefs. If we believe what they believed, we are in apostolic continuity. Still others have said, no. If we worship like they worshiped, but in a different sense that the Orthodox means it, we're apostolic. So that one tradition is convinced that the earliest churches worshipped without musical instruments. And so by avoiding musical instruments, we worship like they did. Or another tradition believes that some of the ancient churches worshipped on the seventh day, not the first day. And so they kind of say, if we worship when they worshiped, we are in the tradition of the apostles. Still others, the leaders of the house church movement in Europe and North America, basically think that it's where we worship that counts. They worshiped in homes, so we worship in homes. We worship where they worshiped. Pentecostal Christianity basically believes that it's in apostolic continuity if we have the same kind of spiritual experiences they had. Still other churches say, we are in continuity with the earliest church because we are organized like we think they were organized. They have had deacons and elders, so we have people in roles that we call deacon and elders. That makes us apostolic. In contrast to all of that and more, Celtic Christianity, begun by Patrick's evangelization of Ireland, offered a contrasting perspective and question. In a sense, they asked, what was their main business? What was their mission? We are in the tradition of the earliest apostles and their churches. Only to the extent to which we share in their mission to pre-Christian people and populations. Patrick and Columba and the others meant no disparagement of any of the other possible answers to the question of how do we recover apostolic Christianity. But they seem to be saying, if you're not substantially sharing in their main business, by comparison, you're just playing church, no matter how apostolic you like to think you are. The Celtic wing of ancient Christianity began with a remarkable man named Patrick. On the handful of occasions when I have been invited to speak to Catholic gatherings, two or three times on St. Patrick's Day, no less, I've begun with the words, St. Patrick was not as great as Roman Catholic Christians assume he was. He was far greater. Let me tell you why. And I begin with this story. Some of you have read it. Back around 400 AD, a boy was being raised by a Briton Celtic tribe of people in what is today northwest England. His family was kind of local aristocracy. During the Roman occupation, they had learned Latin, and Latin became their first language, though they could still cope in the Celtic language of the servant classes. Patrick was baptized, raised in the church, confirmed. His father was a pillar of the local church. His grandfather had been a priest. This was hundreds of years before celibacy was required of the priesthood. But Patrick was not a confessing Christian. He had an attitude. And he and his buddies lived toward the wild side, and they loved to make fun of the clergy. One day, when he was 16, a marauding band of pirates from the land now known as Ireland swept through that part of England and captured Patrick and hundreds of other teenage boys and young men and herded them onto slave ships. And they set sail for Ireland, where they were sold into slavery. And Patrick, he tells us, was sold to a local chieftain of some local prominence named Miliuk. Patrick quickly figured out his job description. Along with the other slaves, most of them from England, his job was to herd cattle for Miliuk's people. And so there were times when he was out in a wilderness herding cattle with his only companion, an industrious border collie or a Welsh corgi, or some predecessor breed to those. Other times, he lived in the slave compound connected to the settlement of Miliuk's people. two currents began running through Patrick's life. One, there were undoubtedly some Christian slaves in the company of slaves who undoubtedly formed into a group where they worshiped and prayed and ministered to each other and interceded for each other and included Patrick in their company. There were other times when Patrick was out in the wilderness with the cattle, where he experienced great isolation and loneliness in this world of nature, observing every sunrise and every sunset, and hearing the songs of birds and experiencing Ireland's ever-present wind. And in that isolation, he thought about what he was learning in the company of Christians in the settlement, and remembering what he could from his confirmation training several years before. And he started praying. In time, he tells us, he was praying perhaps 100 times a day. Perhaps that many times at night, and would typically fall asleep praying. Through this experience, three things happened in Patrick's soul that were to catalyze a significant change in Western history. First, he became devout. He experienced such remarkable transformation of his whole personality that the change was obvious and transparent to his captors. And in time, they stood in awe of him. Second, he discovered a gift for learning language. In fairly measurable time, he had mastered it, the Irish Celtic language. And he came to understand the Irish culture, its beliefs and its values and its norms and its customs. He understood them so well that the Irish knew that this slave understood them as well as they understood themselves. And the third thing that happened, it was not likely instantly, it occurred incrementally over time. He fell in love with his captors, began yearning for their reconciliation to God, began praying for them, and at some point came to regard them as his people, even more than his people back home in England. All of this time, of course, he prayed for his liberation from slavery. One night after 6 years in this arrangement, out in a wilderness next to the cattle, during the night, while he slept, he had a dream. In this dream, an angel named Victor came to him with a stack of letters from people he had known in the time of his captivity. Excuse me. An angel came to him. I'd already gotten ahead of myself there. Sorry. Had a senior moment. An angel came to him and announced, "Tomorrow morning, you awaken early, before the sun has fully risen. Gather some food and clothing and start walking in an eastern direction. Leave the cattle. They will be protected. Walk. You will be protected. In time, you will come to a seashore. You will see a ship. That ship will take you to your freedom. Patrick, your ship is waiting. And the next morning, he obeyed that directive. Walked for several days. Came to the seashore, saw the ship, negotiated his way on board. There were some complexities there that we won't go into now. And the ship took him to his freedom. We don't know exactly where the ship took him. Indeed, the next 20 or 25 years of his life, we have only fragmentary data for that. And of course, the Celtic scholars squabble over what that data means. We believe he spent some time in Rome. We believe that he spent some time at the monastery of St. Martin of Tours, who had launched the first mission to countryside people. We know that he wound up back in England. We know that he acquired a theological education at some point, though we do not know whether it was in Rome or England or somewhere else. We know that he became a parish priest, serving not far from where he had was raised. When? At the age of 47 or 48, he had another dream one night. And it was in this dream that an angel named Victor came to him with a stack of letters from people he had known in his captivity. And the first letter read, "O holy boy, come and walk among us again." And he awakened the next morning, vividly recalling that dream and interpreting the dream as his Macedonian call to take the gospel to the Irish. Now, folks, you won't believe the next part of the story. But he told his bishop about the dream and what he believed the dream meant. And his bishop bought it. His bishop interpreted this notable event to the other bishops in England. They bought it. They had the idea of sending Patrick to Ireland as a missionary. And they sent word to the Pope, Celestine. And Celestine bought it. And even suggested that he be ordained as an apostolic bishop to the Irish. What he was about to undertake was almost universally assumed to be impossible. Because while the earliest apostles in the first century church had reached a great number of barbarian peoples, by sometime in the second century, it was assumed that barbarian peoples could not be Christianized, and that quite included the Celtic peoples, including the Irish. The Irish, like the Goths and the Visigoths and the Franks and the Vandals and the Frisians and the Vikings and other so-called barbarian peoples, were themselves barbarians. by definition, not quite fully human. Therefore, not capable of being Christianized. Why did the politically dominant Roman Church assume that the Irish were barbarians? Basically, for five reasons. One, they didn't speak Latin. Those barbarian peoples out there, if they can't speak Latin, they are, by definition, not civilized. Second, they're not culturally Roman. They don't share our values and customs. How could people like that become Christians? Third, they are not literate. They do not read and write. In the Roman Empire, literacy was considered perhaps the key indicator of whether or not a people were or were not civilized. Fourth, the Irish were known in their primal religion, the religion of the Druids, to sometimes practice human sacrifice. Barbarian, the Romans agreed. And fifth, in warfare, Celtic armies, including Irish armies, had some of their soldiers, particularly their spear throwers, wearing nothing except sandals. In their primal religion, they believed that if they came at the enemy this vulnerable, their gods would protect them. This theological nuancing would have escaped the attention of the Roman armies, but they would have noticed that some of the opposing soldiers came at them buck naked, so to speak. And those stories made the rounds back in the Roman Empire like wildfire. And any such people were, by definition, barbarian. Folks, let's pause a moment at those five reasons, because they're not as antiquated and irrelevant as they might think. Look at the first one. They don't speak Latin. Have you ever been in any churches where they assumed that some people probably couldn't become Christians because they don't speak our language? They don't have an ecclesiastical or theological vocabulary. They don't know the treasured words of the tradition. How could such people become Christians? The second one, not culturally Roman. Have you ever been in any churches where they wrote whole populations off because they do not share our customs and our moral norms? Third, not literate. How many Protestant churches do you know of in this country and other countries around the world that believe that the way to reach pre-Christian people is through home Bible studies, which presupposes literacy? The Protestant Christian mission worldwide, by and large, has never extravagantly assumed that pre-literate people could become Christians. There are a few notable exceptions, but not nearly enough. We have usually assumed that literacy, like circumcision for the earliest church in Jerusalem, is a prerequisite to becoming Christian. Now, the parallels to practicing human sacrifice are admittedly a stretch. But we tend to write people off because they already worship in some way that is alien to us. And if they already worship very differently than we do, how could those people become Christians? And again, a stretch, like the spear throwers. Many churches seem to assume if they don't look like us, dress like us, and act in ways that we can fully approve of, they are not candidates for Christianization. So that in disguised and adapted forms, those kinds of tests may still be much with us. But the other side of the equation is that the Irish, when Patrick and his band went there at about 432 AD, the Irish were prepared. The religion of the Druids was a spent force. The Irish were open to something else. And so Patrick recruited an apostolic band of about a dozen people in England, taught them all the Irish Gaelic that he could remember. Largely through stories, we think, he taught them a great deal about the culture of the Irish people. By now, there had been enough amalgamation in Ireland that all of the 150 or so tribes of Ireland were more or less speaking the same language and living by the same customs. And so they launched out to attempt what was widely considered impossible. But one reason they had the freedom to do it is because the Pope, Celestine, had private doubts about the validity of his church that only civilized people could become Christianized. For the next 28 years, Patrick and his band itinerated from one settlement to another, reaching people and planting churches, while multiplying apostolic bands and churches in every receptive settlement, and multiple congregations in every church from the beginning. And by the time of his death in 460 AD, they had been the agents of an astonishing achievement. Ireland at that time, and I'm now on page 2 or so of your outline, Ireland numbered perhaps 150 tribes, perhaps a total population of 350 to 400,000 people. There were maybe 1,000 to 2,000 settlements spread across much of Ireland at the time. By Patrick's death, our best estimate is that he and his people had reached and substantially Christianized approximately 40 of those 150 tribes. His successors took up where he left off, and by around 500 AD, virtually all of Ireland had become substantially Christian, and in just two generations, Ireland had moved from being the least Christian province in what was technically the Roman Empire into the most Christian province per capita in the entire Roman Empire. In 563, the Irish Church sent Columba and an apostolic team to establish a monastic community on the island of Iona, which would be used as the training and sending center for reaching the Picts of northern and central Scotland. In 633 AD, Iona commissioned Aidan and an apostolic team to set up a monastic community on Lindisfarne, now called Holy Island, which was the beachhead for preparing several generations of people that reached the Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes and others that had stormed into England in migration patterns that had largely displaced the Britons who were there before. Meantime, in about 600 AD, Columbanus was sent by the Irish Church to start gospel movements among the various barbarian populations of Western Europe. And in several generations, they had multiplied monastic communities and apostolic bands and churches and movements. And Western Europe had become substantially Christian for a second time. That brought Europe out of the so-called Dark Ages, ushered in the Carolingian Renaissance and the so-called Holy Roman Empire. And that, in the words of Thomas Cahill, is how the Irish saved Western civilization. The question that I became interested in, if my wife, the professor of psychiatric nursing, were here, she would say no. The question he became obsessed with is this question. How'd they do that? What approaches and methods did they devise to begin where the Irish and others were rather than where God wanted them to be? The question of method and strategy is a serious question. And it's a more complex question than it ought to be. My favorite line from Albert Einstein is the line where he says, everything ought to be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. And when I read that some years ago, I suddenly discovered that's where I've struggled most of my life. In the academy, we seldom make it as simple as possible. And the churches and the agencies keep trying to make it simpler than is possible. Let me ask you to experience for an extended moment the complexity of this. You have on your outline a case study that I've written, adapted from my book. I want you to take about 12 minutes by the stopwatch. Read that case study. And then at the end, around the table where you are, start to answer the question that I finish with. What will you and your apostolic team do as you approach the Irish in mission? Take 12 minutes, first in reading and then discussion. Okay. You people like and enjoy each other entirely too much. We'll have to sow a little bit of dissension in your ranks. Now, my book was designed to provide intelligence-based answers to the question, how'd they do that? The basic question of mission strategic approach. And the second 10th anniversary edition, revised, coming out in a couple of weeks, updates some of that, adds a section of a chapter and a new chapter covering material that we'll actually look at in the second session here. What I have now in front of you is kind of a repeat of what's in the book, but through a different set of lenses and through an alliterative device, 10 C's. The first is do whatever is necessary to establish your own credibility with the target population. And as we'll see in our next session, one reason why you take your own formation seriously as a Christian and as a Christian community is because the people to whom you offer gospel and grace will study your face and study your life for what Emerson called the authentic sign. If they see it, they will be receptive. If they think they don't see it, they may walk away sorrowfully. The 20th century pioneer in this category was the marvelous German theologian Helmut Thielicke, who as a theologian and pastor devoted his life to reaching secular populations in post-war Germany. And in his still marvelous book, The Trouble with the Church, he wrote 30 or 35 years ago, the most important single variable in whether or not people will take the church's message seriously is what he called the credibility of the witnesser. The credibility of the witnessing community. For years, in my field research, I interviewed secular people, several thousand of them altogether. I still do a bit of that. And I discovered that Thielicke was perhaps even more right than he himself perceived. For virtually all secular seekers, the credibility of Christians and the credibility of the church is a towering issue. But I was able to refine and nuance it beyond Thielicke's own insights as I discovered that the credibility question cuts three ways. Some people out there wonder whether or not we really believe what we say we believe. Another group wonders not whether we really believe what we say we believe. They wonder whether or not we actually believe, what we actually live by. What we apparently do believe. And the third group, probably the most growing group, appears to not doubt that we believe what we believe, say we believe, nor that we live by it. They question whether or not it makes much difference. And some of them ask, whether Christianity is at least possibly a kind of faith that could change the world. Folks, that's a serious question. It is a legitimate question. And it introduces an area of probable necessary reform in many churches. In recent years, as I've spent time in churches, I've overheard as much conversation as I could. I've been asking the question, when Christian people in churches are talking, and they're talking about Christianity, and they're talking about what it means to be a Christian, what is it that they assume is basic about being a Christian? Folks, I came up with a six-fold answer that characterizes at least 80 to 85% of all the people I've overheard. To be a Christian, our people often assume, is to be a nice person who has accepted Jesus Christ as his or her Savior so they can go to heaven when they die. And between now and then, they attend church, live a clean life, and have a daily devotional. That's the prevailing operative paradigm, I think, in thousands and thousands of Protestant churches. Christian is a nice person who's accepted Jesus, so they'll go to heaven. Until then, they attend church, live a clean life, and have a daily devotional. In my most recent book, The Apostolic Congregation, I suggest as a bit of a provocateur, there's nothing wrong with that paradigm. There's just not enough right with it. It's a form of Christianity with some of the heart removed, more of the brain removed, and all of the vertebrae removed. It is not a form of the faith that stands any chance of changing the world, because it does not even substantially change the people who already believe it. I'm asking this question. What if Jesus Christ, in addition to being Savior, is also Lord and the Prince of Peace, calling his church to be a kingdom people and God's avant-garde in the world, working for peace, justice, reconciliation, and the restoration of God's good but harmed creation? What if we started preaching, teaching, modeling, and working for a kind of full-orbed version of biblical Christianity, including the prophetic dimension, that if enough people took it seriously, it would indeed change the world and more closely approximate the kingdom that is promised? Credibility. It's interesting, significant, how much credibility other people saw in the Celtic Christian leaders and people. The Venerable Bede wrote the early history of Christianity in Great Britain, was opposed to the Celtic branch of the church because he believed that you ought to do church everywhere in the established Roman way of doing church. And the idea that you would contextualize the forms of Christianity with each receptor population, Bede regarded almost as an obscenity. If you're not doing like it's prescribed from Rome, you're not doing church the right way. And yet, as Bede reflected on all his search had turned up about Columba and Aidan and Cuthbert and other Celtic leaders, he admitted he found them to be totally credible. He could find no fault with any of them. Imagine this. Patrick, at the age of 48, returned to an island society that assumed it still owned him. He returned at great personal risk, declaring that the high God has revealed himself and come to us and died and was raised for us in Jesus of Nazareth. And he makes it possible to become us the people, for us to become the people that they were born to be. Throughout the 28 years, Patrick lived in frequent danger. Sometimes when they went from one settlement to another, they had to hire protection. And yet the fact that he continued to risk his life and freedom for the sake of the people he had come to love fueled a kind of credibility that is almost impossible for us to imagine. The second point is more easily ventilated. Clearance. Wherever Patrick and his band met first with the chief or the local king or baron and gained clearance to camp next to the settlement and engage in conversation with the people. It would remind you that when you're planting Christianity anywhere, you begin with the opinion leaders and the influencers. Because if you don't, they have enough influence to do you in and destroy your credibility locally. And if they're on board or at least sympathetic, they can introduce you to a lot of other people. Third, they camped next to the people and contacted the people on their turf. They made friends. Spent enough time in conversation with the people to understand the people, their culture, their issues, their struggles. Got to know them well enough to know some of the beliefs that they could build on. Some of the aspirations of the people that they could build on. They engaged in ministry with the people and prayed with the people and were there to help settle disputes and engage in other ministries. And they began all of this on the people's turf. It's not like they set up a church and invited people to come to us. It begins with us going to them. Fourth was the feature of community. For Celtic Christianity, Christian faith is intrinsically communal faith. You are prepared for a life of mission in one of the monastic communities. Then you reach out to settlements as a micro community, an apostolic band of about a dozen people or so. You invite people who are receptive and interested into the life of your fellowship, where for a while they spend 24 hours a day with you and your company. The monastic communities are also open to seekers, and seekers are invited to come into the larger monastic communities and spend as much time as necessary until they discover what they will do with Jesus, who is called the Christ. And the goal in every settlement is to raise up a core number of believers and plant a church. It's a community faith. And from the beginning, the church that you plant and the chapel that you build, from the beginning, will have multiple congregations. There is no record or trace of a record that they ever started a church that just had one congregation. Indeed, it would have been logistically impossible, because scholars tell us that the size of the trees available for lumber in Ireland at the time, combined with the available technology for building buildings, would have not permitted anybody to build a chapel anywhere that exceeded more than about 60 or 70 or 80 in attendance. So if you engaged a settlement of 1,000 people and half of them became Christians, you would have 6 or 8 congregations from the very beginning. The fifth feature is communication. In the new edition of my book, I've expanded that chapter significantly. Our most significant challenge is to communicate the gospel and the meaning of the gospel to target populations who have no Christian background, no prior acquaintance, and do not already know what we are talking about. And the Celtic movement did this in different ways: teaching, preaching, music, storytelling, the visual arts, folk arts, analogy, poetry. There is no reason to believe they ever put all or most of their eggs in the preaching basket alone. And sometimes they combined genres, as in this ancient poem. Three folds in the cloth, yet only one napkin is there. Three joints in the finger, yet only one finger fair. Three leaves in the shamrock, yet only one shamrock to wear. Ice, snowflakes, and frost, each in water their origin share. Three persons in God, to one God we make our prayer. And they seem to have believed that nobody gets it the first time or the second time or the third time. You engage in the redundant communication of the gospel, expressing it in as many imaginative ways as you can over time. The sixth point is conversation. The earliest biographies of Patrick stress his ministry of conversation even more than his public preaching and teaching. He typically would meet with a group of people. They would ask their questions. And out of the resources of the gospel and the Christian treasury, he would give faithful, clear answers to those questions, and would use the question as an opportunity to communicate something else that was important that occurred to him. Some people in recent times have discovered and studied the art of evangelical communication. Perhaps the most important of those was a book written 31 years ago by Russell Hale, a splendid Lutheran sociologist of religion, entitled The Unchurched: Who They Are and Why They Stay Away. In that book, Russell Hale suggested that evangelism as one-way presentation, me preach, talk, or teach, you listen, was becoming a spent force. But two-way conversation appeared to be clearly in the ascendancy. As best he could tell, when Christians are doing this, it's about 80% listening and about 20% talking. And in his interviews with secular people, unchurched people, in the 7 or 8 most unchurched counties in the USA, he discovered most of them can't hear until they've been heard. And so he reintroduced the ministry of conversation. Having taken up that gauntlet for the better part of 3 decades and introduced a number of generations of students, I'd like to share 3 discoveries with you. Number one, if you engage in the ministry of conversation with pre-Christian people, you will discover that you already have the answers to some of the questions that people really do ask. Indeed, all of those years, going to church, doing Bible studies and other studies, going to college, for many of you going to seminary and all that has not been a total waste as far as apostolic ministry is concerned. You've already been entrusted with some of the revelatory wisdom that fits the questions and anxieties that people express. That's the first discovery. You are already entrusted with much of what they need to know. The second great discovery is this. You don't have answers right now to some of the other questions that they ask. That discovery will drive you to your knees, back to the scriptures, to theological sources, to the reflecting community, and you can learn more useful theology, reflecting on the questions that you couldn't at first answer, than you would ever acquire in an entire degree program in desk theology. Third discovery. You'll discover that you do not have and cannot find immediately satisfying answers to some of the other questions that people ask, such as questions around suffering and natural disasters, the kinds of questions that surfaced in epidemic numbers following 9/11 and Hurricane Katrina and other tragic events. And frankly, some of those questions have perplexed many of our most profound theologians who believe they have come up with only fragmentary answers to those questions. But the good news is this. They never fantasize that you or I are some supreme arch Mahatma guru who has all of the answers to life's perplexing questions. They didn't need all of their questions answered anyway. They only needed some of their questions answered. Enough that they conclude that becoming Christian is a reasonable thing to consider. There are some good reasons on its side. Furthermore, what makes the difference is not so much what you say as the sacramental power of conversation itself. So that when I was a teenage boy in Miami, Florida, seeking out answers to some of this mystery, a friend of the family, 3 years older than me, named Teddy Hubert, engaged with me in a number of conversations. Today, I do not remember verbatim anything that he said. What worked its way in my soul was the insight and meaning that leaked through the conversations themselves. The seventh point is contextualization. Celtic Christianity, in contrast to the Roman branch of Christianity, practiced indigenous Christianity before we knew what to call it. They believed instead of imposing alien cultural forms upon a host population, you get to know their culture well enough to adapt to their culture, so that the meaning of the gospel is best communicated through the style and the language and the aesthetics and the music of the target population. Venerable Bede's beef was that they did not do the church the Roman way. And their answer was, that's right. We adapt to the tongues and cultures of host populations across our entire mission field. And we do that without apology. Number nine, the theme of continuity is the one that I experience some discomfort with. But in contrast to the Roman approach to primal religions, a kind of slash and burn approach, the Celtic movement built what bridges it could with the any of the questions and beliefs and aspirations of the people in their prior religious experiences that were in any way consistent with revealed Christianity. So, for instance, if in their primal religion they had worshipped beside a sacred tree, that's probably where the Celtic movement would build its church. If they had worshipped next to a tall standing stone, you might put the church right there. And in time, that stone was carved into a Celtic cross. The priests wore their hair and their clothing in a way that was reminiscent of how the Druids had dressed and their haircut, but not exactly the same. And they even learned from their hosts. They saw how the Irish and other Celtic peoples loved the creatures of nature. And this drove the Celtic leaders back to the scriptures and discovered that these pagans had approximated the attitude toward creation more clearly than sometimes the church had. You can't document this anywhere, but it seems to be presupposed everywhere. They seem to have assumed that as Jesus came, said he came not to destroy the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them. So the extension of the body of Christ comes not to destroy so much as to fulfill the religious aspirations of the people that they've already experienced. Ninth, we find in Celtic Christianity's expansion consistency with three major church growth strategies. You typically identified the most interested people and the most open and receptive people, including the most receptive opinion leaders and influencers, and you began with them. As some of them became involved and even believers, you reached out to their pre-Christian friends and relatives, people in their social network. Those social networks provide what McGavran called the bridges of God. And third, everywhere they expanded, they proliferated churches, congregations, groups, apostolic bands, leaders, etc. The tenth point is what I call the conviction. Let me come back to that, referring you to the chart below, which I'm borrowing this from Bishop John Finney in his fine book, Recovering the Past. The Roman approach to reaching people was to proclaim and teach the gospel, Second, invite them to accept it. And if they accept it, we welcome them into the fellowship. But the Celtic model began by inviting receptive people and welcoming them into the fellowship. Where you engage in ministry, including the ministry of conversation, when in time they have experienced the gift of faith, you then invite them to commit to what they now believe. A very different paradigm, increasingly relevant for postmodern people, and it's driven by the kinds of convictions in point 10. It's the conviction that the so-called barbarian people, if you approach them right, can produce their fair share of apostles, prophets, saints, and martyrs. A C.T. Studd, great British cricket star, founder of a late 19th century mission agency, used to suggest, most Christians prefer to remain within the sound of church and chapel bell, but I would rather run a rescue shop within a yard of hell. There is, Charles Wesley said, a wideness in God's mercy. And it's possible to believe at least in principle in the possibility that any human being can become a follower of Christ if we approach them right. That, however, is a big if. 11 years ago, about this time of year, Robert Shaw died. The conductor of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra and Chorale. Famous in this country and the world for their performance of Bach's Mass in B minor. On the day of his death in 1999, National Public Radio rebroadcast an interview they had done with him in about 1990 or 91 or 92. After Shaw and his chorale and symphony had toured Russia for 6 weeks performing Bach's Mass, he reported that the communist authorities had not allowed Bach's Mass to be performed anywhere in the USSR for over 30 years. But many of the people still loved it, as their grandparents told them about Bach's Mass. He said everywhere we went, in auditoriums, gymnasiums, and stadiums, every concert for 6 weeks was packed out, standing room only, with people standing outside to overhear what they could. During every performance, at least at times, we could see a lot of people weeping. After every performance, people thronged forward to hug us and to thank us. The one on NPR had the wisdom to depart from her list of prepared questions. And she asked him, Mr. Shaw, how did this experience affect you and your people? He said, in two ways. One, I was raised the son of a Lutheran minister, and I always believed in the message of Bach's Mass. But I learned from the Russian people to love that message with all of my heart. Second, he said, since we came back from Russia, we now do box mass differently. She said, how? And he gave her this partial answer. We now perform box mass with just two people in mind. We perform it for people who are hearing it for the first time. And we perform it for people who are hearing it for the last time. I was driving my car as I heard this. And it gripped me so that I just pulled off to the side of the road to brood and pray. And something deep within me said, that's right. If you know who you're doing it for, you find ways to do it differently. Not sure what we do at this point. I think we have 5 minutes to squander. And we'll have more than that after my second session. Are there any questions or comments or cussing or discussing? Or I've got 8 minutes. What questions do you have? I hope I've not generated a hot bit of apathy. It's, yes. Hi. Yes. They observed that some of these pagans loved God's creation more than Roman Christianity did. And they experienced that observation as judgment. And we can observe that across Europe for the last generation and across this society in recent years. There is no reason why Christianity should be the caboose in the movement to restore God's good creation to health. And we may have something to learn from that. They found power in a number of the Psalms, for instance, that spoke with profound affection for creatures, birds, animals, lambs, donkeys, eagles, etc. And they especially loved Jesus' quick line in the Sermon on the Mount, where he said, not even a sparrow can fall to the earth without the Father's concern. And that, I think, is a dimension of the revelation that we probably need to recover while there's almost time to do that. Yes. That the Roman model is a very appropriate model, at least in some version, for engaging people with whom it is likely effective. Particularly people, and there are great numbers of them, who are still stuck in modernity, are kind of left-brained personalities, and are more scripted to get their minds around propositional revelation. And I still use the Roman road and the four spiritual laws some when I'm in conversation with people for whom I think this is might be appropriate. We have, from our evangelical and Roman heritage, we've already had that model as an arrow in our quiver. And what I would propose is that the Celtic model is another option for us and is more indigenous with most of the postmodern people we now find in all of our communities, where they're less left-brained and more right-brained, where emotion and imagination are more of the avenues into who they are and can become than rational discussion alone. Yes. Hi. Yes, the danger of syncretism is always a danger. It's such an ever-present danger that whenever I'm with a group, with a church or a group of church leaders who see syncretism almost everywhere else, but assume that their community is immune from it, I'm experienced enough now to be at least a tad suspicious. I would submit, for instance, if a church has not adequately distinct between the Christian ethic and the white middle class moral code, you've got a pretty classic case of syncretism there. And we could expand those kinds of examples enormously. Nevertheless, the other danger, the polar opposite of syncretism, is irrelevance. And churches that are aware of both of those dangers seem to find ways of navigating between those dangers without being seriously compromised by either. The prophet tells us that as the rain and the water come down from heaven, not to return to God void, but to prosper in the purpose for which it was sent, so should God's word be. Not to return to him void, but to achieve the purpose of communicating its meaning. Syncretism is, of course, a serious compromise of the gospel. However, if they can't understand it, or they don't perceive any of its relevance, the gospel has been compromised. You may have protected it in some pure form, but you have not fulfilled the purpose for which it was sent.